Hello, and welcome to another episode of A-Minder. I'm Ellen Rowe, and I've got a great episode for you this month on vascular contributions to Alzheimer's disease. This episode covers papers that showed up on PubMed in February 2022, and we've got another longer episode this month with 17 papers, mainly clinical studies. So lots of neuroimaging to unpack how cerebrovascular damage and vascular risk factors feed into neurodegeneration and cognitive decline, and some interesting treatment avenues that target the vasculature. Stay tuned to learn more about the implications of blood vessel health in Alzheimer's disease, and for disease perspective, a bit more lively than the classic amyloid cascade hypothesis.
Welcome to A-Minder, a podcast where we summarize the latest publications on Alzheimer's disease for you, so you can spend more time doing awesome research. For every month, you'll find a series of episodes by theme, and each comes with a bibliography. Whether you're in the lab, on the bus, or cooking your meal, we hope you find this podcast useful and accessible.
All right, let's get right into it. As always, I'll start with some context for the new listeners, so go ahead and skip ahead if you're already familiar with the landscape of this research, or if you've already listened to one of my episodes. So the brain is one of the most highly vascularized organs, with no more than a hair's width between any neuron and its closest blood vessel. As you likely know, or can infer from that fact, the cerebrovasculature is critical in keeping the brain healthy and functional. It plays a lot of key roles, like being the highway of nutrient and oxygen delivery to the brain, it's a main route of waste disposal, including amyloid clearance, and its highly selective blood-brain barrier is critical to keep blood proteins, pathogens, and peripheral immune cells out of the brain. When these functions are compromised, like when there is reduced blood flow to the brain, or when the blood-brain barrier is compromised, this can lead to metabolic stress and inflammatory cascades. So really, the blood vessels may actually be responsible for some of these initiating events in the AD pathology. As a field, we're starting to appreciate that vascular dysfunction is an early event in the AD pathology, as we see changes in cerebral blood flow and loss of blood-brain barrier integrity with age, and with the main genetic risk factor for AD, APOE4. So as we really tune into the importance of the vasculature in maintaining brain health, we're learning a lot about how things might go wrong through the course of developing AD, and how maintaining vascular health and function could be a new way of preventing or treating AD. So hopefully that little spiel got you hooked on the idea that we really need to pay attention to the blood vessels in the context of Alzheimer's disease. And I will make a few notes here before I dive into the content of the episode. First, a reminder that A-Minder includes all papers from peer-reviewed journals for any given month, meaning that we don't exclude any based on our own perceived quality of the science or accuracy of the interpretations. We also mostly draw from the abstracts for the content of our episodes, so be sure to check out the full papers for more details, and really to make your own judgments on the quality of the science before you accept anything as fact. We provide free numbered bibliographies with all of our episodes, so you can note down the numbers of the papers that pique your interest here, and track down the full manuscripts using our bibliography. And finally, to wrap up the housekeeping items, some common abbreviations you'll hear me use in today's episode are, of course, we have AD for Alzheimer's disease, MCI for mild cognitive impairment, BBB for blood-brain barrier, and CAA for cerebral amyloid angiopathy, which is the deposition of amyloid into blood vessel walls. So with that covered, let's get right into it. So I've dedicated the first segment of the episode to clinical insights, mainly with neuroimaging and vascular risk factors. So I'll start with a group of papers focused on imaging features of cerebrovascular disease and how they relate to AD and cognitive decline. So first up, we have white matter damage due to vascular, tau, and TDP43 pathologies and its relevance to cognition. This is by first author Raghavan and last author Vimuri from the Mayo Clinic in the USA, and the paper was published in Acta Neuropathologica Communications. If you've listened to any of my other episodes, you've probably heard me say that white matter hyperintensities seen on MRI are thought to reflect cerebrovascular damage, but they can also be attributed to other pathologies, as we'll hear about in this paper. So here the authors leveraged a more sophisticated MRI technique called Neurite Orientation Dispersion and Density Imaging, or NODI, to produce really granular maps of white matter damage. There are two main readouts of this technique. First is free water measures, which are thought to reflect inflammation that may be related to vascular damage. And the second is neurite density measures, which I think is pretty self-explanatory. So the study included two different cohorts, one community-based, where they sampled elderly individuals, and the other was clinic-based, where they selected amyloid-positive individuals with AD for a grand total of 408 participants in the study. Everyone had PET imaging, cognitive assessments, and MRI done. They found that higher free water and lower neurite density in the corpus callosum mapped with vascular risk factors, while tau, PET, and TDP-43 associated with lower neurite density in the temporal white matter. They also found in the community-based cohort, where vascular risk factors were more prominent, that the white matter damage in the corpus callosum that mapped with the vascular risk factors accounted for the most variability in cognition. This is in contrast to the AD-specific cohort, where tau deposition and its associated temporal white matter damage was the dominant predictor of cognition. So it looks like we've got some distinct etiology-dependent signatures here. So not all white matter damage reflects the same underlying pathology or affects cognition in the same way, and recognizing these patterns could help us diagnose different causes for dementia. We'll keep the focus on free water white matter imaging with paper number 2, titled White Matter Free Water Outperforms Cerebral Small Vessel Disease Total Score in Predicting Cognitive Decline in Persons with Mild Cognitive Impairment. This is by first author Zhu and last author Huang from a big collaboration between groups in China, and their paper was published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. So the Cerebral Small Vessel Disease Total Score was proposed a few years ago to summarize different imaging markers of vascular disease. It ends up being a score from 0 to 4, counting the presence of enlarged perivascular spaces, white matter hyperintensities, lacunes, and microbleeds, 1 point for each, and it's been useful in predicting dementia in several different cohorts, but these authors wanted to know how it would compare to more granular specific white matter free water measures to predict cognitive decline in people with MCI. Their study included 126 people with MCI from the well-defined Alzheimer's Disease Neuroimaging Initiative, also known as the ADNI cohort. And they found that free water measures aligned with baseline cognition and could map to cognitive decline in several areas, while the cerebral small vessel disease summary score was not associated with either. This suggests that free water measures are more sensitive in predicting cognitive decline than a summary score of all cerebrovascular burdens, really emphasizing that microstructural changes rather than macrostructural ones might drive the clinical features of AD. It is important to note, though, that the ADNI participants are specifically selected to have a low burden of vascular risk factors and cerebrovascular disease, since the primary goal of this cohort is to study pure AD. So these effects might be underestimated here. So more on markers of cerebrovascular damage. Next up, we have stage-dependent cerebral blood flow and leukoriasis couplings in subcortical ischemic vascular disease and Alzheimer's disease. This is paper number 3 by first author Tu and last author Wu from the National Taiwan University, and the paper was published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. If this is the first you're hearing of leukoriasis, have no fear. It's just a term for white matter hyperintensities around the lateral ventricles. In the abstract, the authors just refer to it as white matter hyperintensities, so we'll stick with that from here on out. So we know by now that white matter hyperintensities can feed into cognitive dysfunction, and we know that the same is true for changes in cerebral blood flow. But these authors wanted to know how much each factor contributed to changes in cognition and how this may change across dementia stages. So the study included 42 patients with subcortical ischemic vascular dementia, 20 with AD, and 30 who were cognitively normal, all who had MRI and cognitive tests done. To stratify groups based on dementia stage, they used the Clinical Dementia Rating, or CDR, to divide individuals with dementia into either early stage or late stage. They found that measures of cerebral blood flow fed into global cognition, memory, and attention, while white matter hyperintensities primarily affected executive function. In both dementia types, they found that in the early stage dementia defined by the CDR, cortical white matter hyperintensities correlated with subcortical cerebral blood flow, while in the later stages, it was the opposite. Subcortical white matter hyperintensities correlated with cortical cerebral blood flow. So really interesting insight into both of these imaging metrics and how they map to cognition in different dementias. Turns out vascular dementia and Alzheimer's disease are not so different in this case. Paper number 4 mixes things up by folding in some fluid biomarkers, and this one's called Markers of Cerebrovascular Injury, Inflammation, and Plasma Lipids Are Associated with Alzheimer's Disease Cerebrospinal Fluid Biomarkers in Cognitively Normal Persons. This is by first author Jansen and last author Iliff, and this was a collaboration between the University of Washington and the University of California in the USA, and the paper was published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. So here the authors dive into the hot topic of processes upstream of amyloid that feed into neurodegeneration. Could it be that the cascade doesn't start with amyloid? In my opinion, this is very likely. So here the candidates are inflammation and cerebrovascular dysfunction, both extremely worthy of investigation. The authors used a biomarker approach where their overall goal was to map out CSF markers of cerebrovascular dysfunction and neuroinflammation in the context of classic AD biomarkers. They used a cross-sectional design for this and leveraged a cognitively normal sample from 2 randomized controlled trials for their biomarker measurements. They had quite the panel of biomarkers, including plasma lipids, glucose, albumin quotients to reflect BBB permeability, classic AD markers, many different cytokines and chemokines, markers of vascular injury and angiogenesis, and several growth factors. Be sure to check out the paper to see if your favorite markers were included. There's a good chance that they were. So in broad strokes, the authors found that BBB dysfunction mapped with markers of cerebrovascular dysfunction, acute inflammation, and inflammatory cytokines in the CSF. They also found associations between plasma lipids and cerebrovascular injury markers, mainly that higher triglycerides associated with ICAM and VCAM. Using machine learning to wrangle all of their marker data, they found that combinations of blood lipids, BBB dysfunction, cerebrovascular dysfunction, and inflammatory cytokines predicted CSF total tau, phosphorylated tau, and also Aβ42 to some extent. And a reminder that this was all in people who were cognitively normal. So this is more evidence for vascular dysfunction feeding into the AD pathology. I'd love to see more longitudinal studies mapping out the temporal relationships of these markers. So next we have a few papers related to CAA. Again, this stands for cerebral amyloid angiopathy, and it's when amyloid beta gets deposited in the cerebrovasculature. So paper number 5 in our free bibliography is titled Cerebral Microbleeds, Cerebral Amyloid Angiopathy, and Their Relationships to Quantitative Markers of Neurodegeneration. This is by first author Beeman and last author Gutierrez, and this was a collaboration between groups in the USA and Singapore, and the paper was published in Neurology. In this paper, the authors wanted to know whether the links between CAA and microbleeds to overall brain health in Alzheimer's disease hold up in its preclinical phase, so before the onset of cognitive symptoms. They leveraged about 2,600 participants to study the link between microbleeds and brain volume from 3 different cohorts: the Northern Manhattan Study, or NOMAS, which is mainly those who are cognitively normal, the ADNI cohort, and the Epidemiology of Dementia in Singapore Study, or EDIS. They also included another study with 82 confirmed autopsy cases to study the CAA link. Much to my surprise, they found that superficial microbleeds were associated with larger gray and white matter volume, not smaller. From the autopsy cases, they found that CAA was associated with higher cortical thickness, not lower, which I would have expected. With these data, it seems that microbleeds and CAA aren't directly related to tissue loss in the early stages of the disease. So perhaps they have their detrimental effects through other avenues, like microstructural damage, as we saw in that earlier paper. Next, we have more on CAA with paper number 6, which is called Cerebrovascular Reactivity Across the Entire Brain in Cerebral Amyloid Angiopathy. This is by first author Bowden and last author Smith from the University of Calgary, St.FX, and the University of Alberta, all in Canada. And this research was funded in part by the Canadian Consortium on Neurodegeneration in Aging, who is also our sponsor. The paper was published in Neurology. As you can probably guess, having vessels clogged up with amyloid might lead to their dysfunction. And that's what these authors set out to measure. They used a carbon dioxide challenge where participants breathe in 5% CO2 while in an MRI, as this should induce vasodilation and it's an accepted measure of cerebrovascular reactivity. Ultimately, they wanted to see whether individuals with CAA had a worse response to the challenge than healthy controls, and where people with MCI and AD landed on the spectrum, since there's often some level of CAA in Alzheimer's disease. So their study included 26 people with CAA, 19 with MCI, 12 with AD, and 39 healthy controls. After controlling for the relevant covariates, they found that both gray and white matter cerebrovascular reactivity across the whole brain was worse in the groups with AD and CAA than the healthy controls, with most of the difference being in the posterior regions of the brain. They also found that higher white matter hyperintensity volume mapped with worse white matter reactivity, while higher white and gray matter reactivity was associated with better cognitive function in several domains. Overall, it seems that the amyloid clogging up the vessels in CAA does lead to worse reactivity, and this may feed into cognitive impairment. So perhaps it's not tissue loss that's the issue, as the last paper suggested, but rather cerebrovascular function. Definitely looking forward to seeing more work using vascular reactivity as a biomarker. Now we'll transition into a few papers unpacking how the umbrella term vascular risk factors feeds into dementia. So paper number 7 is called The Interaction Between Vascular Risk Factors, Cerebral Small Vessel Disease, and Amyloid Burden in Older Adults. This is by first author Conks and last author Sachdev, and this was a collaboration between several groups in Australia. And the paper was published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. So here we have a study that focuses on how vascular risk factors, cerebrovascular disease, and amyloid are connected, as the title suggests. To do this, they leveraged 216 participants from the ADNI cohort to look cross-sectionally and longitudinally over 2 years at the interaction. They used amyloid PET to quantify amyloid burden, MRI and diffusion tensor imaging to quantify cerebrovascular disease burden, and they also incorporated demographic factors, APOE4 carrier status, and vascular risk factors into their model. They found that cerebrovascular disease burden was directly connected to amyloid burden cross-sectionally and indirectly connected longitudinally. Hypertension and lower fasting glucose also had an effect on amyloid burden after 2 years, but only the effect of glucose stayed significant after adjusting the model. These results suggest that cerebrovascular disease is connected with amyloid load, and glucose levels might be an important modifiable risk factor affecting amyloid burden. Again, a cautionary note that ADNI has very few individuals enrolled with high cerebrovascular disease burden, so results might be affected by the sampling, but this does give us great insight into pure AD cases and the interaction between all these factors. It'll definitely be interesting to see similar studies in cohorts with a more diverse dementia diagnoses. So now we'll get real specific with our umbrella term, vascular risk factors, with this next one called Association of Carotid Intima Media Thickness with Brain MRI Markers in the Atherosclerosis Risk in Communities Neurocognitive Study. This is paper number 8 by first author Wang and last author Lutze, and this was a collaboration between several groups in the USA, and the paper was published in the Journal of Stroke and Cerebrovascular Diseases. There is lots of evidence supporting the idea that midlife cardiovascular health plays a significant role in influencing brain health later in life. These authors dove into this connection and wanted to know specifically whether markers of arterial injury could predict cerebrovascular damage and brain atrophy later in life. They sampled nearly 1,800 people from the longitudinal Atherosclerosis Risk in Communities Neurocognitive Study, who all had ultrasounds of the carotid artery, which is the main artery feeding the brain, and then neuroimaging done about 20 years later. They found that people with the thickest carotid intima media had lower deep gray matter and cortical volume in the temporal parietal region of the brain. When they looked at another measure of carotid artery health, the presence of a plaque, they saw the same results. Surprisingly, they didn't find any relationships with white matter hyperintensities or microbleeds. This data suggests that midlife vascular health can influence neurodegeneration in regions relevant to AD, but the mechanisms aren't quite clear. Next up is association between T-tau protein and A-beta-42 in plasma neuronal-derived exosomes and cognitive impairment in patients with permanent atrial fibrillation and the role of anticoagulant therapy and inflammatory mechanisms. This is paper number 9 by first author Du and last author Gao from the Tianjin Medical University in China, and the paper was published in the Journal of Cardiac Surgery. So atrial fibrillation is an irregular heartbeat often accompanied by a hypercoagulable state. It's also associated with developing dementia, and these authors were interested in whether cognitive performance among people with atrial fibrillation is linked to how long they had the disorder, their anticoagulant therapy, and whether these links were mediated by inflammation. So lots going on here. Their study included 260 individuals who were divided into either the atrial fibrillation group or the normal heartbeat group, and then each group was further divided based on cognitive status. They measured tau and Aβ42 in neuronal-derived extracellular vesicles, or EVs, isolated from the blood, alongside IL-6 and MMP9 in the plasma. They found that in those with atrial fibrillation, longer duration and not being on anticoagulants were associated with cognitive impairment. They also found that the concentration of the AD-related markers in the neuronal-derived EVs was higher in those with cognitive impairment, and IL-6 and MMP9 levels were higher in those with atrial fibrillation. A lot of different data to chew on here, but this does suggest that atrial fibrillation is connected with dementia, and anticoagulants seem to be a useful tool to break the connection. It's also possible that the connection is through higher inflammatory IL-6 and MMP9, which mediates BBB breakdown, and more research is needed to make these mechanistic links. So next we've got something a bit different, but from the same vein. Paper number 10 is titled Identification of Potential Targets Linked to the Cardiovascular Alzheimer's Axis Through Bioinformatics Approaches. This is by first author Andujar Vera and last author Garcia Fontana from the University of Granada in Spain, and the paper was published in Biomedicines. Here, the authors try to tackle the relationship between vascular health and AD through a bioinformatics lens. Now, I'm no expert in bioinformatics, although I am starting to dabble in R, but I'm just going to gloss over the methods here, and you should definitely check them out in the full paper because I don't completely understand them myself. So from my understanding, the authors first looked for differentially expressed genes in calcified and healthy femoral arteries. If you haven't recently brushed up on your anatomy, that's the artery feeding the lower half of the body. From these differences, they focused on the module of genes known to be associated with Alzheimer's disease and branched out from there with protein-protein interaction networks. They then determined the main targets of this cardiovascular disease AD axis, which include the infamous ApoE, its relative ApoJ or clusterin, haptoglobin, and alpha-2 macroglobulin. Perhaps these proteins are the bridge between cardiovascular disease and AD. Of course, ApoE was already on our radar, and if you're interested in ApoE, we don't currently have an episode that covers it, but we do have a free bibliography with all of the papers published about ApoE each month, so definitely check that out. Link is in our show notes. So sticking with ApoE for our last paper before the break, we have Blood and Brain Transcriptome Analysis Reveals ApoE Genotype-Mediated and Immune-Related Pathways Involved in Alzheimer's Disease. This is paper number 11 by first author Panich and last author Jun from Boston University in the USA, and the paper was published in Alzheimer's Research and Therapy. So as I mentioned in the intro, the epsilon-4 allele of the ApoE gene is the main genetic risk factor for late-onset AD, and it's linked to earlier BBB breakdown that maps with cognitive decline. Here, the authors wanted to gain more insight into how ApoE predisposes individuals to AD by looking at differentially expressed genes in both the blood and the brain from 112 autopsy-confirmed AD cases and 67 controls. They focused on genes already known to be associated with AD through other studies, and found that several were significantly different in both the brain and the blood between AD cases and controls. They also found 21 pathways that were significantly different between the groups, 10 of which were enriched in the ApoE4 carriers. Definitely check out the paper for specifics on the different pathways. Interestingly, they also saw that many top dysregulated genes in the brain and the blood mapped well to plasma markers of vascular injury, which were VCAM1, ICAM1, and serum amyloid. They conclude that ApoE4 contributes to AD by altering several pathways, many of which can be linked back to vascular injury via their association with injury markers in plasma. And with that, we're well over halfway through. Another really top-heavy episode, sorry about that. So we'll take a short break here, and I'll be back with some preclinical work and treatment avenues.
I'm Lara from the bibliography team here at Aminder. Did you know the episode you're listening to has a numbered bibliography that you can find in our show notes or directly on our website? And all of our episodes come with their own bibliographies so that you can easily find and look into the papers that interest you. If you're also interested in keeping up to date with scientific publications in Alzheimer's research and working in collaboration with other teammates, we would love it if you consider joining us. Send your CV and an indication of what you're interested in doing with us to aminderpodcast@gmail.com. Enjoy the rest of the episode.
Nearly 1 million older Canadians live with a form of dementia. This number is expected to double within 10 years, and sadly, no solutions exist yet to dramatically reduce these numbers. It has to stop. Research can help solve this problem. We are 350 researchers fully dedicated towards preventing and finding a cure to dementia, and to improve care to those living with dementia. We are the Canadian Consortium on Neurodegeneration and Aging. The solution to dementia could be closer than you think.
Okay, we're back. As promised, we'll jump right into a section on preclinical insights, including methodology and BBB regulation. So paper number 12 is called Prolonged Culturing of iPSC-Derived Brain Endothelial-Like Cells is Associated with Quiescence, Downregulation of Glycolysis, and Resistance to Disruption by an Alzheimer's Brain Milieu. This is by first author Williams and last author Erickson, and this was a collaboration between researchers in the USA and Japan, and the paper was published in Fluids and Barriers of the CNS. Okay, so I've ranted about this before, and I'll rant about it again. There is no perfect in vitro model of the blood-brain barrier. Primary and immortalized human brain microvascular endothelial cells lose their ability to form a tight barrier in vitro, while iPSC-derived brain microvascular endothelial-like cells, or IBMEC-like cells, are exactly that, endothelial-like, because they actually have many characteristics of epithelial cells. Here, the authors wanted to do more to characterize these IBMEC-like cells. Specifically, they wanted to see how these cells change with prolonged culture, since they're typically used within a couple days of differentiation for experiments, but they maintain their strong barrier for at least 2 weeks. In this paper, they characterized the cells after 2 days and after 9 days in culture, post-differentiation. They saw a significant decline in proliferation of the cells at day 9, and that they had a more quiescent metabolic state with lower glycolysis-related proteins and higher levels of glucose transporter 1, but lower glucose transport rates. In terms of tight and adherens junction proteins, they saw lower claudin 5 and VE cadherin, but ZO1 and occludin levels didn't change, which could explain the persistent barrier at day 9. At both time points, treatment with the inflammatory cytokine TNF-alpha was able to disrupt the barrier, and this was in contrast to conditioned media from iPSC-derived neurons carrying the Swedish APP mutation that increases A-beta production, which only affected the barrier at day 2 while the cells were proliferating, not at day 9. This study really illustrates that culture conditions are critical for observed phenotypes and emphasizes the need for standardization of protocols across labs to really keep everyone on the same page. On to paper number 13, more on cell culture with a methods paper called Protocol to Assess the Effects of Dysfunctional Human Vascular Smooth Muscle Cells on Other Brain Cells Using In Vitro Models of Alzheimer's Disease. This is by first author Alvarez and last author Lino Cardenas from the Catholic University of Santa Maria in Peru, and the paper was published in STAR Protocols. So as the descriptive title suggests, here we've got a short and sweet series of protocols focused on investigating the effects of dysfunctional smooth muscle cells on other cell types, predominantly microglia, to shed some light on how events from the vasculature might kick off neuroinflammation. This looks like your one-stop shop for several functional assays and a guide for culturing this type of cell, which may be extended to other vascular cells like pericytes. Definitely check it out for more details. Now into some animal models. Paper number 14 is called Small Extracellular Vesicles from Peripheral Blood of Aged Mice Pass the Blood-Brain Barrier and Induce Glial Cell Activation. This is by first author Morales Prieto and last author Mars from the Jena University Hospital in Germany, and the paper was published in Cells. So this is our second paper on EVs today, but this one is more focused on their bioactive potential rather than their use as a biomarker. We talk about EVs a lot in my lab, actually, and really, like the extracellular matrix, I think they merit way more research attention. I think we're so focused on what's inside the cells, and we should take a page out of the cancer researchers' books and focus on the microenvironment. EVs can be released from many, if not all, cell types, in many different contexts, cell death, cell stress, cell activation, and they can be loaded with proteins and RNAs to affect the other cells they contact. I think they're super interesting and we can learn a lot from them. Okay, so onto the specifics of this paper. Here, the authors wanted to understand how circulating EVs from aged mice might affect young healthy mice to get a better idea of the effects of these circulating vesicles. They isolated EVs from the blood of 3-month-old and 24-month-old mice, labeled them with a fluorescent dye to track their location, and injected them into young healthy mice to observe effects. They found that the EVs mainly stayed localized to the blood vessels, but some crossed the BBB and made their way into the parenchyma. They also saw that EVs from old mice altered gene expression in the brain, mainly with increased GFAP, indicating astrocyte activation. These are some really interesting observations, providing more evidence that the brain isn't as disconnected from the state of the rest of the body as we once thought. Definitely looking forward to see more EV research on the horizon. And our last one of this section is called Activation of the Sigma-1 Receptor Attenuates Blood-Brain Barrier Disruption by Inhibiting Amyloid Deposition in Alzheimer's Disease Mice. And it's paper number 15 by first author N and last author Jia, and this was a collaboration between groups in China published in Neuroscience Letters. The sigma-1 receptor is a protein found in the endoplasmic reticulum that's involved in regulating gated ion channels, among many other things. It's been widely studied in many different contexts, but these authors focused on it as a druggable target in AD. Specifically, they wanted to know how it might rescue BBB dysfunction. They tested this in mice who were given an injection of recombinant Aβ42 directly into the ventricles of their brain, and then treated with a sigma-1 receptor agonist. They found that the drug improved performance in the Morris-Watermaze test, increased levels of the transporter LRP1, improved A-beta clearance, and reduced BBB permeability, as per the Evans-Blue assay. They also saw an increase in VEGF in the treated mice, which they suggested may be responsible for improved BBB function, but I've seen many reports of the opposite, where VEGF destabilizes vessels for angiogenesis and increases permeability. So, some stuff to iron out there. Overall, this paper puts sigma-1 receptor on the map in AD, but more work is needed to figure out exactly how it contributes to amyloid clearance and modulating the BBB. So with the potential targeting of the sigma-1 receptor as a treatment for AD, this leads us nicely into our last section focused on treatment avenues. For paper number 16, we have Anti-HK antibody reveals critical roles of a 20-residue HK region for A-beta-induced plasma contact system activation. This is by first author Chen and last author Norris from Rockefeller University in the USA, and the paper was published in Blood Advances. So if you're new to the world of hemostasis, like me, you might not have heard of the plasma contact system. Turns out this is a group of proteins in plasma, which you'll be familiar with by the end of this summary, that can work together to promote inflammation and coagulation when they bind to or contact certain surfaces. Often this is something negatively charged, but it turns out Aβ42 can activate the system too, and that's where this study comes in. We know that there's increased inflammation in AD, and other studies have found that clotting abnormalities relate to cognition. So maybe inhibiting the interaction of Aβ with the plasma contact system could help fix these issues. Before we jump into the results, it's important to know the important players in the plasma contact system, and these are, please excuse my pronunciation, prekallikrein, or PK, which binds to factor 11, and high molecular weight kininogen, or HK, to ultimately activate the clotting factors 11 and 12, which eventually leads to full clot formation. Here, as their title suggests, when they used an antibody to block HK binding and cleavage, it could stop this pathway in its tracks, including Aβ-induced activation, which depends on cleavage of HK. The antibody was specific to a short stretch of amino acids in the protein's 6 domain and was also able to disassemble bound complexes in plasma. With these data, the author suggests that blocking this pathway might be helpful in the treatment of AD. Definitely an interesting new treatment angle. And last but not least, our final paper today is titled blood-brain barrier permeable beta blockers linked to lower risk of Alzheimer's disease in hypertension. This is by first author Beeman and last author Holst from the University of Copenhagen in Denmark, and the paper was published in Brain. Beta blockers are drugs classically used in the context of hypertension or heart failure, but there has been discussion in the field about their potential use in AD as well. Beta blockers work by blocking the binding of norepinephrine and epinephrine to beta receptors, and it turns out that lowering norepinephrine can also improve glymphatic clearance, that is, the clearance of waste from the brain through interstitial fluid exchange with CSF. These authors hypothesize that if the beta blocker can get into the brain, it might be able to lower the activity of norepinephrine to ultimately improve amyloid clearance via the glymphatic pathway. This was a clinical study where they leveraged data in the Danish National Registers from over 69,000 people treated with beta blockers for hypertension. They classified the different beta blockers based on their BBB permeability and used Cox regression models to estimate time to dementia outcomes based on the beta blocker permeability and a 10-year standardized absolute risk of AD and other dementias. They found that treatment with highly permeable beta blockers resulted in a significantly lower risk of AD, specifically compared to beta blockers that didn't cross the BBB, and this wasn't true for all-cause dementia. Definitely check out the full paper for full details on their analysis, but it seems like beta blockers that readily cross the BBB, like propranolol, might be the most useful in the context of AD, perhaps to help clear A-beta. After a quick search in the clinical trials database, I didn't see any for propranolol in AD, but maybe that's coming down the pipeline. And that brings us to the end of this episode. Hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed stringing these papers together. If you did, we'd love if you subscribed to us and wrote us a review on whichever platform you're using to listen to us. This helps us reach more scientists like yourself and make sure that we're keeping Alzheimer's research a well-oiled and informed machine. A reminder that we offer free bibliographies with all of our episodes so that you can track down the full papers that I've summarized here. You can find a link to all of our bibliographies in the episode notes. We also release bibliographies for topics that we don't currently cover with full episodes as well, like fluid biomarkers and ApoE. So check out those as a resource to start your literature search. Also, we're releasing episodes Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, so be sure to check those out for a range of other topics related to Alzheimer's disease. Huge thank you to the whole Aminder team for bringing this project to life, and especially to our sorting team for their help in parsing out focused episodes like this one, my lovely reviewer Cassie, who's making her debut as a host this month, our wonderful editing team for all the great work they do, our musician Anusha for writing the beautiful music that you hear each episode, and our managers Sarah and Ellen Kosh, who keep Aminder going strong. Also again, thank you to the CCNA for their sponsorship and for believing in this project. If you're interested in joining this wonderful team of ours, we're always recruiting. Send us an email with your CV and let us know what you're interested in helping with. You can also reach out to us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching Aminder Podcast. And of course, thank you, our listener, for tuning in. We hope you find this podcast useful and accessible. Bye for now.